Okay, good evening again. So this is a we've got someone coming in now, as always. One more to come in. So yeah, I said I'd do two. This is the second one, and then I'm having a bit of a break again. So we're going to look at a couple of chapters from Ezekiel and start with just a few background bits and pieces, information. Should you decide in the weeks to come you would like to read the whole of the book of Ezekiel, well, best of luck on that one. But if you do, you might want to know one or two basic things about it. It's actually the most logically arranged and most best organized of all the prophetic books, which often, as you know, are the sort of bits and pieces all over the place. But this book of Ezekiel has a very clear structure to it. There's 48 chapters, and the first 24 are all about judgments against Israel, which actually is pretty hard going. I mean, I do find when I read through all that, I've had enough after a little while. It's a bit repetitive. And then you get another 8 chapters of judgments against other nations, so not much light relief there. And then the last 16 chapters, the whole thing changes quite considerably, and you get something a lot more sort of prophetic. So if the first 32 chapters have all come true at some point regarding Israel, Jerusalem, or other nations, once you get to chapter 33 onwards, you hit some of the problems of, well, when's that going to happen, and what's that all about, and who does it involve? And as you know, the last 9 chapters are about this strange temple, which I think we might have looked at before. But so we're focusing in on chapters 38 and 39 because they go together and fit into this. But Ezekiel was one of those who was taken to Babylon into captivity as a very young man. He was about age 25 when he was taken into exile, around 597 BC. And 5 years later, he starts to have these visions, which he dates very carefully, starting in the 5th year of his exile. So from age about 30, he starts to have all these visions and prophecies. Because in fact, he was of a priestly family, so this was quite different for him. And suddenly his book contains lots and lots of predictions. So I said certain of them have come true, and others remain to be sort of puzzled through. The Jews have a very interesting attitude towards this book. They say that it's really not a good one for young minds. It's best to wait until you're a lot more mature before you actually try and get into the book of Ezekiel. Not because they doubt its value in any way or its authenticity, but just because it's got all these very strange visions, and they really don't quite know what to make about the last few chapters anyway. So they say, you know, leave all that, get on with the Torah and other parts of the prophets and so on. And when you're old enough, wise enough, then maybe you can tackle Ezekiel. Well, I'm sure we're all old enough and wise enough to give it a go, aren't we? There is a key phrase in the whole book, actually, which occurs all the way through, but in different forms. It's basically, then you will know that I am the Lord. And in fact, for the first 24 chapters, it is then you will know, which means you means Israel, the Jews. Because I said their judgments against Israel. Why is God doing all this? So that then you will know that I am the Lord. In the next few chapters, judgments against other nations, it's then they will know that I am the Lord. And when you come to these last chapters from 33 onwards, it's then the nations will know that I am the Lord, or basically then everyone will know that I am the Lord. So the main point of all this is that we get to know that he is the Lord because of what he said he would do. And in the two chapters we're going to look at, time and time and time again, and I think read somewhere about 70 odd times, God says, I will, I will, I will. So this is all very much a matter of God saying what he's going to do. And as we know, he does keep his word. So what I'd like you to do for 5 minutes now is to read chapter 38 of Ezekiel. And then later on, you'll read 39. So we're going to do it in two distinct chapters, even though they sort of go together, but there's a good reason for splitting it. And chapter 38 will probably take quite a bit of our time. So for 5 minutes, I'll mute as well. Have a read through Ezekiel chapter 38, and then we'll start to go through it. Okay, I think we've had about 5 minutes there, so let's start to look through this. The two big questions are who's involved and when is this likely to happen? Just admit one more into the room. Hi. So we're just starting looking at Ezekiel 38. If you just joined us, Ezekiel 38. And I just said there's two main questions, controversial ones, certainly, which is who's involved in all this and when is it going to happen? The what is a bit easier. This is about an invasion of certain forces into Israel from the north. And they invade, but they're then destroyed by the time they reach the mountains of Israel, which is the central part of it. So we're dealing with something pretty horrific along the lines of a huge battle that's going to take place, or at least a huge rebellion. So it starts off with a reference to Gog and Magog, which is how these chapters are usually known. It's all about Gog and Magog. So exactly who is this referring to? What's this all about? I don't know if you know, but Gog and Magog feature in London. If you ever see the Lord Mayor's show, they are sort of the, I don't quite know how you describe them, almost like gods, but figures, big, huge figures that are paraded part of this. And they have some kind of meaning within the city of London. I do mean the square mile city, as though there's some kind of guardians over the finances, but not a very pleasant thought given who these people, who Gog and Magog actually are. Gog occurs 11 times in scripture. 9 times here in Ezekiel and twice elsewhere. I bet you probably know where one of them is. Does anyone know where either of the two other times of mentioning Gog and Magog, other than, as I say, in Ezekiel? You're really clever.
Revelation.
Revelation, any more precisely?
In the ancestry lines, the descendants of.
Oh, sorry, which book are we talking about?
I don't know, are we in Genesis?
Oh, I see, you're trying to give me the other one now. Yeah, okay. When I said, someone said Revelation, I just wonder if you, someone tell which chapter, whereabouts
in Revelation. Oh, sorry, that was me, Paul. It's Revelation 20, verse 8.
Yeah, it is. We'll look at that in a moment. And Alison, you mentioned Genesis.
Genesis?
Yeah, it's sort of, yes. But firstly, because we're dealing with Gog, it's actually in Chronicles. It's that bit you don't read very often. It's 1 Chronicles 5 and verse 4, where you get all this genealogy. So it's the same sort of thing, really. And all you learn about from 1 Chronicles 5, 4 is that Gog is actually a person, a son of Shemaiah. He's a Reubenite, and that's all you're going to know. So not a lot of help. Doesn't help us here in Ezekiel. But maybe the reference in Revelation 20 does. Just hold that for a moment, because Magog also occurs 5 times in Scripture, twice in Ezekiel, once here and once at the beginning of chapter 39. I think it's there again, well, it's somewhere in these chapters. Once in Chronicles, again, 1 Chronicles chapter 1 and verse 5, again in Revelation, chapter 20, verse 8, and in Genesis, chapter 10, verse 2, which is probably what you were thinking of. Now, in Chronicles, this time Magog is a son of Japheth, again, a person, but you get a bit more detail back from Genesis, chapter 10. So we'll have a look at that, because Genesis, chapter 10 is this table of nations. In other words, it's referring to the descendants of Noah, and where they all end up. So you find in chapter 10, verse 2, the sons of Japheth are, and there we've got Magog, mentioned after Gomer, and also you get Tubal and Meshach. So actually, some of the names that you get here in Ezekiel 38, in the first six verses, have cropped up back there in terms of the immediate descendants of Japheth. Again, therefore, because not from Shem, is not therefore a Semite, and therefore not relating to the people of Israel. Okay. Now, from ancient history, we can learn a bit more about the Magogites, or because don't forget, this Magog is a person in Genesis, and that he obviously had descendants called Magogites, and when they spread out from having, you know, come out of the Arkansas, they first settled in the plain of the Euphrates, and then they went north over the Caucasus Mountains. You're going to get some maps in a minute, so don't worry if your geography doesn't quite up to scratch and all this. But they go north over the Caucasus Mountains, for some reason looking for a colder place, apparently. And the word Caucasus, these mountains, which you've probably heard of, but I didn't realise, the actual meaning of Caucasus is Gog's fort. Don't quite know how you get that from Caucasus. But they went into that region. And the next sort of thing in history that we know about them is that they become a group of people called the Scythians, which I'd vaguely heard of. And the Scythians, obviously descended from the Magogites, were very warlike, very fierce, and often would therefore come back south again in order to plunder. And actually, the word Gog simply means high mountain as a sort of derivation. But then from there, as a name, it developed to mean anybody who was huge, and therefore mighty, and therefore warlike. So Gog became not just a name, but a title almost for a ruler or mighty leader. And other names are derived from that. If you think of Og of Bashan, Og is derived from the same word as Gog. And if you know anything about Og of Bashan, he was pretty big. He was the tall one, wasn't he, with the long bed, I think. Another one that names relates to it is Agag, who was of the Amalekites, and he was pretty nasty as well. And you get other names which eventually come from all of that. And in fact, Magog, although we said it's a person in Genesis 10, another way of understanding the word is that M-A at the beginning of the word means land of or territory of. So if you put it together with Gog and talk about Gog and Magog, then you basically get a ruler and his people or territory or kingdom, especially one of a warlike nature. Now, I said I was going to show you some pictures. Let's bring these up. Okay, just check with me again. You can all see this, can't you? Take me a while to get him coming again. Here we go. Yes, special. Right, so some of these maps can be a bit repetitive, but this is just to show you, if I can get it sorted out in my own head. Here we are. This is the Caucasus Mountains. We've actually got quite used to maps of this area in recent times. There, for instance, is Chernobyl. And the descendants of Magog went into this area and became, as I said, known as the Scythians. The next map just puts a bit more detail. Come to you in a minute, Malcolm. So this is a bit more detail where this is where the Caucasus Mountains are. And we all now know that this is Crimea, Mariupol, Odessa, and other places, heading into what is the southern part of what we now know as Russia. And you've got Georgia down here as well. That's again just putting a bit of detail on the map. I'm not sure we need, I've done that one. I'm not sure we need to see that, but again, it's just putting it within the bigger European framework or this area framework. Probably the next one does about the same. I'm just sort of panning out a little bit without adding a great deal of detail, I must admit. But that gives you an idea as to whereabouts we are geographically, next to the Black Sea. I'll just keep going to see what else I've got. Okay, I'll come back to that one in a minute. Malcolm, what do you want to add?
Well, I was just going to say, on that first map, to what age does that refer? Because it mentions Palestine.
And that
never mentioned until about 970 or
980. Okay. I can't guarantee when the actual map was produced, I must admit. But yes, well spotted that the errors there. I didn't actually notice that. I'll pull it up again just to convince myself what you're talking about here. So you're saying on here? Oh, yes, it does. It says it down here, doesn't it? Okay. Well, as I say, this obviously is a map produced by whoever fairly recently, and obviously falling into that trap of assuming this is known as Palestine then, which of course it isn't. Yeah. Okay. Well spotted. No one's ever told me that before. Thank you. So that gives you some idea of some of the background to what these actually mean. So when you come to Ezekiel, it's Gog of the land of Magog, a person or leader of a people or kingdom situated in that sort of area. And from there, we're meant to work out one or two things that are going on. So back in our text in Ezekiel, first and obvious thing to notice is God says, I am against, or set your face against this. And the sovereign Lord says, I am against you, O Gog. And then it goes on, chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Now that needs a bit of unpacking. Firstly, because some translations used to have their Rosh, Meshach and Tubal. And you may have got that in a footnote, but I'm sure you know enough to know that Rosh means head or chief or first in Hebrew. So instead of being the prince of a place, the better translation is to call this person the chief prince of these places, Meshach and Tubal. Now, you could argue, some people do, that there's three people involved here. There is Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach, and the chief prince of Tubal. Or it could be that it's one person with all these titles because he is in control of a much sort of bigger area. So where exactly are Meshach and Tubal? Now, in the past, there's been quite a common sort of idea based upon this misunderstanding, really, that if it really is Rosh as the place, the prince of Rosh, Rosh sounds awfully like Russia, which, of course, is there now. And Meshach sounds a little bit like Mushki or Muscovy. And Tubal even sounds a little bit like Tobolsk. So they try and find them in terms of modern places to do with that part of Russia that we're familiar with. But better understanding now, if I come through all this again, is to be able to pinpoint them in these different places. So, and this time we've got Israel, not Palestine, so that'll please you. And I think I've got a bigger map in a minute, which will pinpoint them a bit more carefully for you. But you can see that Meshach and Tubal are there. And other places that you're going to read about in those six verses, later on you've also got Gomer, which actually is hidden under my screen share thing. Let me try and find another one. This might help a little bit more, although I've got that in the way as well. But Togarmah is there, Tubal and Gomer are there. There's a little bit of doubt exactly where some of these places are, as you might imagine. But they're all in the same sort of area. And The other places that are mentioned, Persia, Kush, and Put. Persia, of course, is what we now know of as Iran, that part of the area. And the other two places are basically in parts of Africa. People think of it as sort of Ethiopia or Libya, but it's in the north part of the Nile region. So they're different because they're in the south. I'm not sure whether that's any use. Here we go. This is another one. That's telling you where Put is. I'm not sure whether, I don't agree with Kush being there. I think Kush is meant to be here as well. That's not a very clear map either. Let's get rid of that one. Let's see if we've got a better one. Whoops. Ah, does this help? Right. This has these more in this area. And Sheba and Dedan are in Saudi Arabia, because they're going to come up, if not immediately, in the rest of the chapter. So we're getting a bit of an idea where some of these places have been discovered to be. I just said we've got one more, whether that's it. Okay, this points out more carefully where Sheba, we've all heard of that from the Queen visit. Dedan is a bit further north in the Arabian Peninsula. And we don't need that one for now. Anyway, that's a pretty good basic, as far as we can tell, understanding that there's all these places in this sort of area that all developed from the original Magog of Genesis chapter 10. I'll pull out of that now. Does anyone want to say or ask anything? I mean, I'll pull the maps up again if necessary, but I think that's enough of that sort of background. There's always a bit of debate exactly where some of these places are, but here we got Jeremy.
Just looking at Revelation 20, verse 8.
Yeah.
It's saying that the nations which are the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog. Okay. So again, that seems to be what you're saying even now. I mean, I think it's talking at the end of the millennium there, but
Well, okay.
Gog and Magog are to be gathered from the four corners of the earth.
Right, let me deal with that one now, because I sort of left it a little bit and I didn't know when to come back to it. What you read about in Revelation 20 isn't the same as in Ezekiel. It just doesn't fit. We'll perhaps run through that a bit more when we've looked at the rest of it. But you've already noticed one particular difference when it talks about the four corners of the earth and so on. So I don't think that Ezekiel is prophesying something that eventually happens in the book of Revelation. Or even sort of vice versa in some way. I think the way it's expressed in Revelation, it's almost like in brackets, that something is going to happen, and the best way of understanding what is going to happen is to refer back to something that's already happened in John's time, sorry, or at least that he knew about from Ezekiel. It's one of those things where background to the book of Revelation is important. So it's almost like, as in most of Revelation, here is a bigger version of something that's already been mentioned and will have probably happened before you get to the one that's going to happen in there. It's like, how can I help this? How can I describe this? What's the best way of describing what John is seeing? I know, I'll refer to it as Gog and Magog, because if you understood the book of Ezekiel, you'll have an idea. But it's not exactly the same thing. It could almost be just an allusion to it, in that there's certain sort of comparisons and so on. But when we come back to having looked at everything in Ezekiel, we'll pinpoint even more differences and particularly see how the timing of it doesn't match up as well. So that will get us going on that. So what have we actually got here then? God is against them. Lovely phrase. Well, not that lovely, but it's worth noting in verse 4. I'll put hooks in your jaws. Now, that was something that the Assyrians first did in order to, basically, it was to control their slaves. It was something they did with their slaves. Literally, they hooked them under the jaw, which basically meant, you've got to come where I'm going. It showed a control issue for them. And God is saying, I'm actually going to do this. Basically, I'm going to grab hold of you in this rather unusual way, and you're going to do what I say, and you're going to go where I tell you to go. So in other words, although we've got this, whatever it is, a sort of confederacy almost of Gog and Magog, of Gog being in charge of all these different areas and launching his forces down south, it's only happening because God has said, I'm in charge of this, I'm going to let it happen because it's for my purposes. So when in verse 7 it says, get ready, be prepared, you and all the hordes gathered about you, and so on, it's God is talking here to Gog, this particular version of this person, Gog, and basically saying, you're going to do what I tell you, so get ready, because you're now about to come together, you'll be called to arms, and you're going to invade a land, which of course is going to be Israel, down further south from there, whose people were gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel. So it's a reference there to the regathered Israel, and the mountains of Israel are always the central part of the land. So it talks about they've been brought out from the nations, and then you get this extra little bit, which is very interesting, and it sort of slightly adds to the confusion, in that it says that they, the Israelites or the Jews, have been brought out from the nations. Now all of them live in safety. Now, if there's one thing that hasn't happened since Israel has been regathered, is you can't say they've been living in safety. And later on in verse 11, when it says, and this time it's quoting what Gog's plans are, I will invade a land of unwalled villages. And what that means, obviously, unwalled means no defences, a land of peaceful and unsuspecting people living without walls, without gates and bars. In other words, they're absolutely open to attack. So he's going to go and do it. Now, there's no way you could say at the moment that Israel is sort of defenseless in the sense that isn't expecting trouble, or is living in peaceful and unsuspecting people. They're expecting trouble all the time, basically. So when you're trying to pinpoint when this might happen, on the assumption that it hasn't yet happened, of course, then you've got to say, I wonder what's got to happen first to get to this situation where suddenly this force says, it's time to go and invade and plunder Israel because they are not expecting it. The other thing to get out of verse 10, when God says, on that day, thoughts will come into your mind, will devise an evil scheme, it's going to be premeditated. At some point, this guy or all his forces are going to put together this plan. Again, it's God that's going to say, you're going to do it now, you know, on that day, it will happen. But suddenly it will come into your mind that you could really do this. You could go and attack them. And so you start to put a plan into operation. And it might take them several years to build up their forces and decide to really go ahead. But once this has started, then they are going to attack. And the reason that they give is, in verse 12, we're going to go and plunder and loot the land, because they're very rich in livestock and goods. So let's go and actually do this. That's going to be their reason for the invasion, which is just a typical sort of one. We want what they've got. Now, it suggests that maybe behind all this, there's the deeper plan of trying to sort of wipe them out again and invade Israel for the purposes of destroying them completely. But part of the scheme of things is, let's go and grab what we can from there, because they're doing very nicely, thank you, and we could do with all these different things that they've got. And I'll just talk about the last little bit, verse 13, and then you can come in with some thoughts if you like. We've already talked about Sheba and Dedan, and there's another place, which we'll come to in a minute, where they seem to question what is going on. They're almost rhetorically here sort of saying, have you really come to do this? Is this really your plan? Have you gathered to do this? It's as though they are doubting what this this guy has said he's doing it for, but they're not prepared to oppose. They're not prepared to come to Israel's defence. Remember, Sheba and Dedan are in a different part of the world. They were down there in the Arabian Peninsula. They sort of raise questions about what's happening, but they don't do anything to stop it happening. Now, the merchants of Tarshish and all her villages. Wonder what you've got in your translation for that. Any thoughts on that little bit of verse 13? Malcolm again.
Tarshish is commonly thought to be Spain, but in other parts of the scripture, talk about tin from Tarshish.
Right.
And there's no tin in Spain.
Right.
And the thoughts that I've heard are that it's the southwest of Britain, in Wales, Cornwall sort of area, where there is tin.
Exactly.
Where Tarshish is.
Okay, that's good. Anyone else want to say anything before I chip in with that? Alison?
I had, when I've been reading about this, I had read that the Spanish heavily bought tin from Cornwall.
They
had a load of tin.
Okay, interesting.
It still allowed it to be Spain, but who knows?
All right, well, I'll give you a bit more clue in a minute. Where do we read about Tarshish most of all? If you ever say to someone Tarshish in the Bible, who do you think of?
Jonah,
yeah. Okay. Now, basically, there's 21 references to Tarshish in the Old Testament, apparently. And if you've heard of Spain, it's because that's assumed where he was going to at that time, because it refers to ships and islands and distant shores and so on. There's also references to merchants and so on. Now, the word Tarshish seems to be used in a more general sense then of the westernmost limit of the then known world, which would obviously expand outwards as time goes on. So at one point it would be Spain, because at that point, particular point in history, the Hebrew thinking was that actually once you got to the sort of Straits of Gibraltar and you kept going further west from there, you're going to fall off the edge of the earth or something. So it's not actually a place, it's a designation of the westernmost limits. Then, of course, eventually people did go further and realised you could end up further. And so the new western limit became us, the British Isles, which is why then you get the idea of Cornwall and so on, for the tin and lead and so on, particularly as the Phoenicians began to travel further, and they seemed to go further than the previous limit and produce a new one, which could well be us. So the reference to the merchants of Tarshish, and what about the villages? Did anyone have anything to say about that in their version of the Bible or any thinking on that? Merchant of Tarshish and all her villages. Alison?
A reference in mind to the lions, the strong lions being the village.
Strong lions or young lions. And the way people understand that is that if Tarshish represents this sort of westernmost limit, then villages actually is a bit of a weak word. The young lions are all the countries, if you like, that go with that particular area. So, for instance, if it was Spain, then it would be eventually the Spanish Empire. They were strong at one point and had lots of young lions. If it's us, of course, we had an empire or commonwealth and so on. So it seems to be talking about a Western sort of alliance or group of nations, not villages, but something stronger than that. That together with these other two places actually raise these objections. But as I say, raise the objections and do nothing. Presumably don't want to get involved in a major conflict just in case it affects them. Interesting thought there. So they make this protest, but it's probably a bit weak. Yes, Malcolm?
It sounds like Ukraine at the moment, doesn't it?
Well, you picked up my little hint there, did you? Okay. Yes. So a mild protest, no action, just in case it escalates to their part of the area. So I think we've probably got as much out of the first 13 verses as we can in a brief sort of scamper of all these things. You can read in books that people have slightly extra ideas attached to all of these things. But it's a major invasion of a confederacy led by one very warlike leader and all his associates into the land of Israel at a time when they are not expecting it and feel relatively safe under the ploy of we're just going to war to win stuff like we, you know, people do, but maybe with a bigger purpose in mind. But there is a bigger purpose in mind, and that's God's purpose, because that's why in verse 14 onwards, he says to Ezekiel, prophesy and say this to God. And what we learn from that is that, God is good at outlining basically what they're going to do. Again, when my people Israel are living in safety, I wonder when that could possibly be. You will take notice of it, won't you? You will come from your place in the far north, you and many nations with you, all of them riding on horses, a great horde, a mighty army. You will advance against them like a cloud. In the days to come, I will bring you against my land. Here's the question, the point again, we said, so the nations may know me when I show myself holy through you before their eyes. God is in charge of this. He's going to do something that ultimately will glorify him, and everybody will then know that there is effectively a holy God in Israel, or looking after Israel. And this is what's going to happen from verse 17 onwards. This is what will happen in that day. When Gog attacks the land of Israel, my hot anger will be aroused. Now, this is when God's anger really boils over, not just a little bit angry, not just a little bit annoyed. This is going to be as devastating as any other time that you can imagine. And he talks about there being a great earthquake that's going to happen. Everything is going to be shaken. And out of this, that's how God is going to defeat and destroy this colossal invading army, because he's going to use his natural weapons, if you like. What have we got here? I think we've got rain and hailstorms, hailstones and burning sulfur and so on. All the sort of things that you read of in other prophecies, which is basically Israel themselves are not going to win this. It has to be God himself acting on their behalf. And I say, you get references of this same sort of thing happening in so many other prophets. I don't know if you bring any to mind or want to share them. But this is what God is going to do. It's almost like he's setting a big trap for them, because as he's often done before, he uses invading forces to work out purposes against his people, and then he deals with those invading forces. They're going to break up. There's going to be infighting and so on. Okay. So we're nearly at the end of this chapter. I'm going to say a couple more things perhaps, but anything that you've got out of reading that chapter, just to add to the general understanding of it?
I wonder if Israel's going to feel at peace when the nations around them sort of say, okay, we give up, we'll sign the declaration of peace and we'll leave you alone. So it's a false peace.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of thing has got to happen. We're going to answer in a minute a little bit more about when this could be. But it's certainly, when people say, oh, this is about to happen, or it's the next thing that's going to happen, the big prophetic thing on the timetable, something else has got to happen to get Israel into this state, first of all. You've got to take into account all the details. So if it happens tomorrow, it can't be the Gog and Magog version of it, because Israel doesn't feel secure at this point. Malcolm?
Sorry, I think you were saying too much, but in verse 13, it says they're going to carry off silver, gold, livestock and other wealth.
Yeah.
Take much plunder. Well, Israel's not a very rich nation. not a lot of silver, gold, and other wealth. But what they do have, and what I've heard from several sources, is that Israel has gas.
Yeah.
And at the moment, they supply Egypt and Jordan with gas. And there's a talk about this pipeline, which Turkey is trying to stop, going to Cyprus. You're supplying gas through Cyprus to Greece and into Europe, which the Russians don't like because it will be a lot cheaper than what Russia are selling their gas at.
Yeah, or trying to sell it at now. Yeah, but anyway, yeah. I mean, excellent point. Don't forget, in all these things you read here, it's going to be written in sort of Old Testament terms. So it's bound to talk about livestock and silver and gold, just like it talked about the invading forces on horses and so on. But I think you're right. And I think maybe they might even find oil eventually there. There could be other mineral sources that will suddenly make Israel very attractive from that point of view. But of course, it's not perhaps the main reason they're going in there. But anyway, Betty?
Yes, a thing that comes over to me very strongly, more strongly than ever before, is the fact that the Lord has engineered all of this and is leading all of this. I find it quite easy to accept that the Lord has allowed things to happen through our wickedness, but he's actually organising and orchestrating the whole thing.
What we often find with this sort of thing, and indeed looking at the world, we see what's happening on Earth. We see humans doing things, including our Gogs and Magogs and whatever else around at the moment. But we never see the spiritual side of it, the heavenly battles and so on, which are often behind all this. But that's where the prophecies do assure us of this sort of thing. John? Or Jan?
I thought they had got oil offshore.
Yeah, maybe I'm not up to date on that. You might be right, but I don't know if anyone else knows any more details about that. But I mean, I'm not that sure about the gas situation, but I think I've heard something like that. But this sort of thing can happen at any time, really, you know.
As I understood it, someone was praying and saying, well, Lord, you promised to provide everything that we as a nation need for life.
Yeah.
What about energy? We haven't got any oil.
Yeah.
And the Lord supposedly said, look out to sea, mate.
Yeah. So something like that's certainly going to happen. Yeah.
They found oil beneath the gas.
Oh, I see.
Extracted any yet.
Right. Yeah, they often, I suppose, go together. I don't know. I'm not an expert in that sort of thing. Let's at this time do a bit more of a comparison with the Revelation 20 verses. So if you haven't looked this up yet, Revelation 20 verses 7 and 8. Again, it's more to do with contrast at this point. Because if God is bringing forth Gog in Ezekiel, in other words, he's making this happen, the thing that happens in Revelation is that it is Satan that goes out to deceive the nations. So, again, you can say, well, God's always in control, but there's this extra element here that there's something directly from Satan bringing forth this Gog. In Ezekiel, Gog comes from the north, and we've already said in Revelation it's from the four corners of the earth. So this is much more, if you like, global. It's much more like you expect going to happen at the very end. It's going to centre upon the Middle East. A lot of it will centre upon Israel still, but more worldwide. In Ezekiel, it talked about Gog being a great horde or multitudes, but here it's like the sand on the seashore, which is similar sort of expression, but to me is even more so. In other words, it's an even bigger. It can't just be a horde or a multitude. This is phenomenally big. It's almost like everybody, all the nations, like sand on the seashore. Both end up being destroyed, if you read on in Revelation, and both talk about fire. Fire come down from heaven and devoured them. But also that happens here is it ends up with the devil and the beast and the false prophet being thrown into the lake of fire, which is not a reference here in Ezekiel. But what actually happens to Gog, as we'll read on in the next chapter in a minute, is that this Gog is killed and buried, in the land, whereas in this case, Gog and beast, false prophet, and so on, they're actually destroyed directly by God and thrown into the lake of fire. So this Gog in Ezekiel is not the same as this Antichrist figure from the very end. So trying to decide exactly when it will happen, and I'm not going to try and be over precise or predictive about this, but people have come up with lots of different answers. For instance, some people say, oh, it's at the end of the millennium, it relates to Revelation 20. Well, I'm going to be precise about that. I don't think so. It just doesn't work out to be the same. Is it going to be during the tribulation period? Is it part of what happens halfway through this terrible period? Is it going to be towards the end of it? Does it relate perhaps to Armageddon? No, if you read carefully, it doesn't relate to Armageddon in the same sort of way. It doesn't relate anything to do with the tribulation. It seems to be something that's going to come earlier than that. I'm not going to try to put a date or anything on it like that, but it seems to come before then, because it all sort of comes to a head and is over with during this strange time when Israel are at peace. So something's got to happen to make that happen. But then the aftermath of it doesn't read like now this is just the last bit of the tribulation and then on towards the return of Jesus. So without trying to put too much of a detail on it, I think this is one of those events, those steps on the way, if you like, one of those birth pains where at some point world events will suddenly gather up and this will start to make sense when it actually happens. Alison.
So where do you see the Psalm 83 war fitting in?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't thought about that. Tell you what.
Because that actually sets Israel up.
Yeah, okay.
So they're in a place of unparalleled richness and safety.
Oh, right, okay. I tell you what, I'll have a read of that while you're having a read now of chapter 39, because that's what I'd like us to do next before we spend the rest of the time looking at chapter 39. So I'm going to give you 5 minutes away from me to read through the second chapter, chapter 39. I'll have a little look at Psalm 83, and we might discuss that in a minute then as well. Okay, 5 minutes for Ezekiel 39. Right, I think we about had 5 minutes there. So I'll try and answer my homework question, which was what I make of Psalm 83. My initial thoughts, just off the top of my head from this, I don't see this as being a specific prophecy of any great event. I see it more as a very general thing that has happened or will happen repeatedly. It's almost like a template of it. This sort of thing will have occurred and will occur. It's a general thing of enemies conspiring, come let us destroy the nation of Israel so they're remembered no more. And in the end, God deals with them. So to me, I see it's a more generalized sort of pattern here, because after all, it is a psalm. It isn't really, I know psalms can be prophetic, but I don't think it's trying to pinpoint one particular thing. But I did notice at the end, it says, let them know that you, whose name is the Lord, that you alone are the most high over all the earth. In other words, yet again, that they will know that you are the Lord. So I think it's almost a sort of, here's the pattern of things that's going to happen several times. So that's the thought on that I'm going to say. Now, I could have said something before you read Ezekiel 39, and I forgot, but maybe you sort of picked this up by reading it. What I don't want you to think is that this is happening a second time. This is the same events as chapter 38. It's what scholars on prophecy call the law of recurrence, where Ezekiel, in this case, is going back over the same events and filling in more details. So the first chapter is like an outline, like an artist just sort of sketching something, putting the broad view in place. So you've got the scenario, and now he's going back and putting in some finer details and clarifying a few more points. So it starts off pretty much the same. I'm against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. I will turn you around and drag you along. I'll bring you from the far north and send you against the mountains of Israel. So the scenario is set up in the same way. And then from verse 3 onwards, you get details that you didn't get in chapter 38 of what's going to happen to them, which is basically that God is going to destroy them, disarm them in the first place. All their weapons will come to nothing. They will fall, i.e. die there, and their bodies will be lying there in the land, and it'll be dealt with like that. You'll fall in the open field and so on. But also in verse 6, God's saying, at the same time as destroying the invading forces that have come into my land, I'm also going to send fire on the place you've come from, because he wants them to know that I am the Lord. So he's dealing with the nations that have sent these attackers and so on. And again, verses 7 and 8, why is this happening again? It's again so that my holy name will be known amongst my people Israel, and indeed through the nations as a whole. This is God's usual twofold plan. There's a very interesting phrase in verse 7. Look at the end of verse 7. Now, you can tell me if you've got something different in your translation, but what I have is that the nations will know that I, the Lord, am the Holy One in Israel. The Holy One in Israel. Does anyone have anything slightly different from that? Or perhaps you might have expected something a bit different.
The nations will know that I am the Lord, the Holy One of Israel.
Right. Now, that's the most usual phrase for this, that God is the Holy One of Israel. But in this case, the Hebrew does say the Holy One in Israel, the little prefix that you put at the beginning of the word is Kadosh Bat Yisrael or something. And this is the only time this phrase, Holy One in Israel, occurs in the Old Testament. All the other times it's the Holy One of Israel. So is it just one of those little translational things and you just sort of skip over it? Other people make something of that. Does that mean that at this point God is actually, if you like, there personally? Does this therefore refer, in Old Testament terms, to his Messiah being there? Which is, for people want to put it at the sort of end of the tribulation, the beginning of millennium, and they want to link it in with the return of Jesus, they point to that and say, if they're going to know that the Lord is the Holy One actually there in Israel, then it must refer to the second coming and so on. As I said, for other reasons, I don't see how you can time it quite in that sort of way. But it is an interesting extra detail in that phrase because of its uniqueness. Does anyone else, what do your translations tend to say? I mean, the NIV has got the Holy One in Israel. Which version did you read there, John, when you said of?
That's the Amplified.
Okay. Oh, the Amplified probably has everything going, does it? what do others have? Maureen? You'll have to unmute.
Thank you. I've got going on the next verse. And it says, behold, it is come, and it is done.
Okay.
Saith the Lord God. And that reminds me of when Jesus was on the cross.
Okay, yeah. Well, I've just got it. It will surely take place. This is the day I've spoken of. It's just God being emphatic about, this is coming, this is happening. Yeah.
Oh, that's good to know. Thank you.
Yeah, it is. But Holy One in Israel. And then when else got any others? Malcolm?
CJB says in Israel.
Says in, yeah.
Verse 8, it's future tense. This is coming and it will be done.
Yeah. Well, that's just a typical way of stating a prophecy, really, from that point of view. But yeah, in is the correct translation. It's just whether you try and make more of it. John again? Or Jan?
I was looking at verse 6.
Right.
Those who live in safety in the coastlands.
Yeah.
Is that the West Bank?
Not really. The coastlands would be on the the actual coast of, say, like the sea. It's a good question as to whether that means the coastlands of Israel, because basically they're coming into the mountains of Israel, which of course is the central bit. Mm-hmm. So it's going to happen in the coastlands as well. Or it could refer, as it often does, to the distant coastlands, where it could be any other country. So this, mm-hmm. this could be more sort of dispersed.
Yeah, in the One New Man, it says, and those who dwell carelessly in the isles.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think we had that phrase in chapter 38, but you often find that the idea of the isles or the distant coastlands, it's not really talking of like sort of the beaches sort of thing or the sort of coast that we think of. It just means far-flung areas. So it's as though something else is going to happen wider in this bit. I've got Alison, and then I don't know if Maureen's got her hand up again.
Translation for verse 7. I've just looked up the range of translations, and it's New King James is make my holy name among my people Israel.
Okay. Oh, I see. In as in amongst the people. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. That's it. That's good. Okay, now more details coming up verse 9 onwards, which we didn't have before. And this is an interesting bit because there's a reference now to 7 years of basically aftermath of defeat, aftermath of war, again, couched in bows and arrows terms and so on. But because all the enemy have just been destroyed, all their weaponry is lying around. And so those in Israel go and collect them all up. And obviously, if it is bows and arrows, I think the best thing to do with them is to burn them. We'll save our fuel, save our gas bills and so on by burning this sort of stuff up. Quite what that would turn out to mean when it comes to more modern warfare. But the idea is that there's a large clear up going to happen. And that goes on through the rest of the chapter. And if we take this to be, you know, usually fairly literally, and that seven does mean seven and things like that, that does suggest, therefore, that there's got to be this length of time after this battle. In other words, it can't still be in the tribulation where one, all sorts of other things are happening, and the tribulation as a whole is at most 7 years, probably just the main 3.5. So that would have to put it earlier, so that be the big clear up afterwards. And you've also got verse 11 onwards, it takes 7 months to clear away all the dead bodies, and it gives the impression that they're going to have to employ special people to go out and do this, regularly employed to cleanse the land. And you know how careful and indeed fastidious the Jews are with dead bodies and body parts that come out of warfare and terrorists and so on. They look for every little bit because they have to bury it all and not leave it around. And it talks about that here, that if they even see a human bone left, you can't just leave it there or just chuck it away. You've got to mark it so that it's dealt with properly and so on. So they're very sort of, well, typical Jewish, if you like, about dealing with the aftermath in terms of the equipment, but also the dead bodies. Malcolm.
Interesting thought that they're referring to wood from the weapons, but obviously they had no concept of tanks,
no.
Missiles and everything made of metal today. There's not much wood used in armaments.
No, indeed. But maybe whatever is there, they will sort of plunder it and use it in some way. But as I say, it's got to be written up in terms they understood then. John?
I was just going to say, you know, if you say that it's going to be the Jews that are going to clear all of the aftermath of this war up, and it's going to take them 7 years, just thinking about the tribulation, halfway through the tribulation, God has told the Jews to flee the land, hasn't he?
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah.
Israel halfway through, so that would indicate that this could be, at least 3.5 years before the start of the tribulation.
That's another reason why it does not fit the tribulation period, or the revelation period, if you like. Yeah. It's interesting that they almost have to build a new place in order to deal with this. So they're going to bury all the hordes. This is where we learn that Gog himself is actually going to be buried there. So it's not the same as the guy in Revelation that's thrown into the lake of fire. And they're going to call it the Valley of Chamon Gog, which my footnote tells me means the hordes of Gog. So it's like a huge sort of mass grave area is going to be created. And nearby, they're going to create a new town called Chamonar, that's verse 16, which means horde, in order to cleanse the land. So they're having to put a place, separate place for all this. And in fact, it says in the burial place is going to be in the valley of those who travel east towards the sea, that is the Dead Sea. So they're going to have to find some kind of space or area there for dealing with all that. Now, what you do get in verse 17 onwards actually is another one of these things that reminds you of something, like the book of Revelation, where in the big battle there, it talks about the birds coming to actually help do the clear up. So this might now, one of the things you get, this sort of prophetic recurrence thing, is occasionally you think this is really stretching ahead and it belongs somewhere else in time, and the prophet is seeing something like on a distant mountaintop, and you get a little extra prefiguring of something which eventually you read about in the book of Revelation. So I think there is a bit of a shift going on from verse 17 onwards to something that we might think, oh yes, that's going to have another fulfillment later on because of what we know from the book of Revelation. That's Revelation 19, verses 17 and 18, which is the banquet for birds and beasts, invitation to come and do that. But again, this could be symbolic anyway. And also from verse 21 onwards, it now talks about all the nations will see this. Now, that again looks as though if now it's all, as in every single one, this could be a bit more worldwide again. It could be done something later. And people do say that the reference to displaying my glory does actually mean Jesus coming back, because he is the glory of God. He's coming back as the Shekinah. So they start to see another more distant future parallel of things that are going to happen. And the only final little point that I get out of all this is right at the very end. Again, he's talking about showing himself to be holy. Then you will know that I am the Lord. I sent them, I gathered them, I'm dealing with all this. And at the end, I will pour out my spirit on the house of Israel, declares the sovereign Lord. And the only other time and place where we read about that is in the end of Zechariah, where you do get a prophecy of at the very end, where again, enemies have invaded the land. They're about to destroy Israel completely, but God intervenes and they cry out for their Messiah to come, and Jesus comes. And as part of that process, God says, I pour out my spirit of grace and supplication upon them, and therefore they really come to know me. So I think we're getting, again, more hints here that whatever's going to happen in this particular event, it's foreshadowing something that God is going to do again right at the very end, when he says, I will no longer hide my face from them, because that's at this point, this is referring to the return of Jesus in a future expanded sort of version of this same sort of thing. And this is the point at which, if you like, God has finally dealt with Israel, and all Israel is saved and come into the kingdom at the time that their king comes back. So I think within Malcolm.
So going back to verse 17, I've always read that as being the birds and every wild animals are coming to eat the flesh of the conquered armies.
Yeah, that's right. As you keep reading on in verse 17 and verse 18. Yeah, indeed. I mean, some birds and some animals would do that naturally anyway. And as I say, in Revelation 19, again, you get the repeat of that. It's almost like there's so many of them. The animal kingdom comes to Israel's help at this point. So that, and that's why it says, if you see a bone remaining, because that might be all that's left after the birds and the wild animals have come to their great great feast. So it's a sort of horrible picture, but it's a realistic one in one sense, but also very much clearly what God feels has to happen to deal with all this. John or Jan?
Yes, me for a change. When you get to verse 25 onwards, it is describing a time of peace in Israel when they were not afraid of being plundered, which sort of sounds rather like the bit that we were looking for earlier that we said hadn't happened yet. But that's before the scrap.
I mean, it could be going back to something said earlier. You know, it doesn't always have to be stretching out into the future. It can get a bit sort of time unrelated, if you like, and this. So, yeah, you're probably right. It might be flitting backwards to something there.
Just another thought. It's sort of fair that God brings in nature to do the clear up, because he's brought in nature to do the shaking at the beginning.
Was anyone else? Just another hand up. Jeremy, yes.
I think it was Chuck Missler, wasn't it, that was talking a lot about radioactivity, and this sounded like as if the clear-up was partly due to nuclear concerns. Yeah. And that, I think he was saying, might fit in with the way in which the products could be used for energy, but I'm not sure how that
works. Yeah, the equivalent of burning wood is I don't know, like, yeah. You get the same sort of picture in Zechariah. Again, it's quite horrible, but it does sound like something biological, chemical or nuclear actually happening here to destroy the attackers. John or Hilary?
I was just sort of thinking about the timing of this, and, you know, we sort of discussed tonight that we think it's before the tribulation. And we don't know when the rapture is going to be. The Lord hasn't told us that, has he? But if you think about the Lord and the way he operates, he doesn't normally leave himself without a witness on the earth for very long. And we know that the 144,000 are going to be raised up during the tribulation. So it could be that if the rapture is close to the start of the tribulation period, that the church is actually here for when this event happens. And if we are, then it's just amazing, isn't it, that God says in these passages that you will know that I am the Lord. It could be an absolutely wonderful evangelism opportunity.
Well, that's a very good point, because if he wants his glory to be known throughout all the nations, it will be in order to bring more people into the kingdom. I pick up that bit of the thing. I'm not going to be drawn into the first bit of what you said, but I like the second bit. Now, is it John or is it Jan?
It's me again. Just wondering what the media would make of this feeding frenzy of all the creatures of the earth. Yum!
Oh, and if this was wood and it was all burnt for 7 years, oh, what a scrap there would be from all the folks who are fighting about the effect on the planet.
Oh,
the
climate change. Indeed.
And if it's nuclear that's being whatever processed.
Well, I mean, I have to admit that the recent events that we are absorbed in from the news has made me think again about some of these passages. Again, not trying to be overly predictive and so on, but just to clarify my own understanding of what's there and realize that they're there for a purpose. And again, rejoicing that God's hand is on everything. We just sort of have to watch and pray and see what's going to come out of this particular scenario and what it might lead to after that. But certainly if you go back to the 60s and 70s and 80s, more when I was growing up, there was a lot of this kind of prophetic thing, which certainly related to the Soviet Empire, which we then, of course, broke up, but hasn't ever really gone away. So it remains part of what's happening in that that area of the world, isn't it? And it was interesting looking at the maps to see that the Magog area was just north of the Caucasus and therefore into part of the world that we're very absorbed with at the moment, aren't we? Oh, I'll tell you what, I talked about London earlier. So I'll share, if you haven't seen these, these are just it's not one image, it's a whole range of them. But are you aware of these figures that you see in the Lord Mayor's Parade? And they're there, where are they now, on one of these? They guard, somehow they're there. This is all to do with the square mile in the City of London. I don't know whether they're anywhere else, but these figures there. I don't know how these figures have come to be part of our past and therefore our future, or you know where we are now. Rather. But somehow Gog and Magog are... Of course, we've said that Gog is a person and Magog is a land, although Magog was originally a person in Genesis, but they've become figures that are attached to the City of London in some way. John or Jan?
Have they always been part of the Lord Mayor's Parade? Because my dad used to take me to watch.
All right.
I don't remember them, but then I was under nine.
Yeah. Maybe they just, as far as I'm aware, I mean, I've just pulled up the pictures without actually getting any more detail. I remember them when I was there once or twice. I haven't been that often to see it. Doesn't totally interest me. But
I was more interested in the horses coming along. And one year they brought the army after the horses.
But they're there.
They weren't allowed to swerve.
They're there in the parade because they're there in these buildings, which obviously go back some way. I mean, who eventually put these figures up somewhere? I don't know quite how that works out. Pat?
I actually took part in one of the parades, one of that. It was celebration of energy at the time, but I don't remember any of that Gog and Magog. Okay. However, I wasn't a Christian at the time, so it might have been something that passed me by.
Yeah, so you may not know what it was. You just think, oh, there's two big giant things there. And it's such a big parade, isn't it, that actually if you're involved in it, you don't see it all. You think about it, you have to start from miles back and come in at your right time. So, John or Hilary?
I was just thinking about going back to Ezekiel 39, verse 6, when the Lord says, I will send fire upon Magog. And if we're thinking about Magog being a land, and I thought it was a good map that you put up to show where it was, really southern Russia. If that is the destruction of the southern part of Russia, do you see that as a, because at the moment we've got an east-west divide, haven't we? We've got Russia in the as the east, and then we've got the west as we have it. That could be, if there was a destruction of Russia, that could be the end of an east-west divide and start to see something like a one world government, which we know we're going to have in the end times.
Well, yeah, again, you can raise all these questions and make all these things, and absolutely correctly to think about it like that. I'm not going to say one way or the other. I'm just going to say, yeah, who knows? But, you know, the world does shift and reshape from time to time. But I think in terms of spiritual powers, they dominate certain areas. I think this is what I was trying to get at last time with the beasts from Daniel. That's what I did last time, wasn't it? To make us realise that, as in always, there are spiritual powers behind all this, and then ultimately God behind it all as well. But it doesn't always matter of sort of who's there and what you call the country or whatever, but there's certain areas of the world seem to have, probably going back over all the millennia, how long it is to when these things happened in the first place, you know, and people took charge of places and spirits got involved. Yeah, Malcolm?
Complete digression, but when I was young, and I'm talking about the 40s, there was a saying that many people use was "Beware the Yellow Peril," referring to China. Of course, that doesn't come into this area. At least I don't think it's done.
No, not so. Did you mean the 1940s, Malcolm? Just checking. You set yourself up for that one. But yeah, assuming that. No, in certain prophecies where it talks about the East, people think that might now refer to that. But it wasn't a it wasn't a consideration in biblical times, was it, really? Obviously, there were people there somehow, but it wasn't like we have now. Right, well, there we are. Thank you again for going through this with me. And that's it for a while. I just have to keep your ears open to, or eyes open to the emails or someone to find out what happens next. But there won't be anything for at least a month, because I'm partly away or out and about on Thursdays, but also I want to have a bit of a break from doing too many things of this kind. I don't want to keep going all year, all through the year, all the time. Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Paul.
Okay, perhaps I'd switch the recording off in case people now want to...